The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Inflation soared in November, rising to its highest level in nearly four decades. Data from the Labor Department shows the Consumer Price Index jumped 6.8%, the highest rate of inflation since 1982. In a statement, the president downplayed the data, saying, quote, the information being released does not reflect today's reality, and it does not reflect the expected price decreases in the weeks ahead.
I think we're stuck with negative real rates for a very long time. Whether it's food or fuel or travel or accommodations, you see that the purchasing power of our capital has depreciated massively in the last 2 years, and it's only going to worsen from here.
U.S. President Joe Biden on Wednesday said putting American troops on the ground in Ukraine to deter a potential Russian invasion was, quote, not on the table, particularly without the support of NATO allies.
It would depend upon what the rest of the NATO countries were willing to do as well. But the idea the United States is going to unilaterally use force to confront Russia invading Ukraine is not in the cards right now.
After a months-long financial drama, China's Evergrande officially considered in default, a result of a downgrade from Fitch, the developer failing to meet two coupon payments after a grace period ended on Monday. This sets off a long battle ahead of for who will get paid from what remains of this company.
This is not just a default of Evergrande. This is a default of China and their banking system, who has pushed Evergrande ever so forcefully for the last 10 years to build and build and build. And now they're going to have their Bear Stearns moment.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Without any negative news over the weekend, stocks were allowed to rally on Monday, and that effort carried through until Thursday when the aggressive rally took a break. At its intraday highs on Tuesday, the S&P 500 had rallied 4.2% and the Nasdaq was up 5.3% from last week's lows. The consensus view is that the Omicron variant of COVID is no more infectious than the common cold, and the economic impact not as bad as feared. Transport stocks were big winners on that sentiment. As of Wednesday, United Airlines was up roughly 11%, Delta up 8%, and American Airlines was up nearly 9.5%. On Wednesday, Pfizer and BioNTech shared news that preliminary lab studies indicated three doses of their current vaccine neutralizes the Omicron variant, and two doses may still provide protection against severe disease. Additionally, on Thursday, the Senate passed a procedural bill allowing the debt ceiling to rise a fixed amount, and the FDA approved Pfizer and BioNTech's booster for 16 and 17-year-olds, so some real positive news there. Thursday was a consolidation on the rally. The hardest hit areas were the ones that rose the most this week. The consolidation was rumored due to concerns still over the Omicron variant, but I think it was more as a sidestep to possible news related to the CPI release on Friday, in case the news was awful. The other reason the markets corrected in weeks prior had to do with the hawkish statements from the Fed speakers, and most importantly from Powell, retiring the word transitory before Congress. The Fed meets next week, so a very hot CPI print could see more aggressive taper language in the policy statement. Well, Friday came and the CPI was hot, with the highest annual consumer inflation rate of 6.8% since 1982. As Ryan Sweet put it, frequent guest here on podcast on Moody's Analytics, the November Consumer Price Index essentially seals an acceleration in other words, the Fed's, tapering. The monthly increase was 0.8% and 0.5% for core. That's without food and energy. But instead of reaffirm the corrective stance traders took Thursday ahead of this report, it did the opposite Friday. Before the report, the 10-year Treasury was up 2 basis points to 1.51%, and the 2-year was up 3 basis points to 0.72%. I think that because the number was so hot, traders are now certain the Fed will aggressively taper, and certainty is something traders can plan for. Treasury yields fell across the curve, and especially of note was the 2-year, which is sensitive to the Fed rate hike expectations after the CPI's release on Friday. The 10-year was at 1.45%, and the 2-year dropped to 0.65% last I checked. Whatever the reasons traders had to short cover or bid up treasury prices, it caused some comfort in stocks to know that the bond market was this calm at the sight of such a hot CPI print. Upbeat earnings for Broadcom, Oracle, and Costco may have also had something to do with it as well. The information tech sector took a big lead Friday as a result of those earnings. Last, I wanted to mention a theme that has been building large cap stocks of late that was relevant this week. Intel announced it will be spinning off its mobile eye unit mid-2022. It's estimated the deal could help Intel raise $50 billion or more in proceeds it could use then to continue building its foundry base or advance other directives it's planning on data center, its new push into graphics chips, and, of course, networking chips. Intel's plan is similar to those we've seen from Dell, General Electric, Johnson & Johnson, and Honeywell, which have been spinning off their best-performing business segments, driving earnings growth. We also have Engine Capital, a firm invested in Kohl's, who's suggesting a spinoff of its e-commerce business, like Jana Partners suggested of Macy's, which rocketed 25% higher after similar news, as well as, of course, advances we've seen in Johnson & Johnson and GE stocks on their spinoff news. This trend seems to be picking up speed, and investors who do their homework might want to consider high-profile blue-chip companies with similar situations. That's it for the key news this week. All eyes will be on the Federal Reserve policy statement and conference call afterwards on Wednesday, but I think after Friday, it's baked in the cake, we will see a more aggressive taper. Goldman, prior to Powell's retirement of the word transitory, was estimating we'll see the taper double in size from $15 billion a month to $30 billion a month to finish early. We'll see Wednesday. And of the three near-term negative catalysts holding back the rally in the stock market this fourth quarter, we've seen some real developments recently with the debt ceiling adjustment, as well as the comfort we're seeing now with the Omicron variant. Up next, this week's technician.
Something that's very closely related to technocracy, perhaps it's the other side of the coin, fitting again with the social engineering aspect of things, and that's transhumanism. Do you mind telling us a little bit about that?
This is part and parcel of the Great Reset. I'll say that right up front. And the reason I say that, the simplest way to understand this, I think, is looking at the World Economic Forum. Klaus Schwab has openly stated that the Great Reset is not merely just the economic system of the world, you know, moving into sustainable development to, you know, controlling all resources, et cetera. But he talks about the merging of technology with the human condition.
Ladies and gentlemen, the future is already here. It's a new system. It changes us because it's a fusion of our physical, digital, and biological spheres. It's an integration. Just think of sensors planted into our brains. The opportunities are immense.
He talks about first wearable technologies, then implantable technologies. He talks about life extension. He talks about ultimately conquering death. Transhumans believe that they can capture or hijack evolution. They say, hey, why wait for millions of years when now that we have genetic engineering, why don't we just kind of take over the process and we'll speed it up and we'll redesign mankind in our own image.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Joining us on the show today is Ron William. He's the founder and market strategist at RW Advisory. And Ron, when we last spoke with you in August, you had warned that based on your work, the market was likely to be weak in September. The U.S. stock market peaked right at the start of that month and corrected into October before bouncing higher until now in recent weeks, where we've seen some pretty volatile action. As you know, we usually see a so-called Santa Claus rally as consumer spending picks up into the year end with all the gift giving. That said, what is your technical work telling you about the recent market action with only a few weeks left in the year?
Well, certainly it's been a rocky ride post Black Friday, 26th of November, day after Thanksgiving. And we've been pressured with further known unknowns. So notably, the new variant, Omicron, and the hawkish Fed pivot. And so just on those points quickly, being prepared for multiple viral mutations is part of learning how to live with COVID. That's our preface for that side of the equation, which is ongoing 2 years later. But meanwhile, the hawkish Fed and policy U-turn came as a surprise to most, despite long-term investors already pricing in three hikes in 2022. And ultimately, whichever event risk we look at, it's the initial volatility spike on proxies like the VIX, which we had originally predicted as part of a earlier on negative seasonality during September and October, which is traditional. But what is less so is for that to continue into December, as you just mentioned, as part of the Santa Claus rally. So we believe that will be muted this year based on our global ranking model that looks at cross assets and just what that suggests in terms of the business cycle and risk on, risk off, but also our timing methodology, which includes cycles and some proprietary indicators that suggest that volatility will continue to be elevated into the new year of 2022. But one key point here is on a tactical basis, this rebound is likely to continue higher on markets like S&P 500. So we could see a best case scenario of, you know, certainly new record highs, but then more specifically that round of phobia level at 5,000 with a potential for a market top in Q1 next year with mean reversion risk in the second half of next year.
Okay, so best case scenario would be that we reach new highs in the first quarter, perhaps taking out that 5,000 level in the S&P 500 before the end of the cycle or a near-term peak. What are you looking at broader in the 2022 timeframe?
According to our cycle work, we've had cyclical bulls within a secular market that is now reaching its end game. We dubbed that the Minsky risk from the last year or so. And so there was a previous podcast interview where we actually discussed the Minsky risk, where we were maybe a little bit too early and ultimately off on the market call was thinking that market top would have appeared earlier than it otherwise would have. So it seems like the elastic band has overstretched as much as it can. Certainly irrational exuberance has been ripe. And on a strategic level, we do see that unraveling into next year. But just to be very clear, tactically, this is potentially another buy on the dip opportunity, specifically on markets like S&P 500. If you just look at quarterly 50-day average, where we have literally had this line in the sand that the market has managed to hold above for more than a year, with exception to the last shakeout in September, October, which we had originally predicted as part of the negative seasonality trend, that line in the sand has held. And so that buy the dip opportunity and that Pavlovian conditioning to buy on the dip, buy on the dip, buy on the dip is going to be strong. And not just in that market or equities, but just any risk on play where the trend has been strong and volatility has been minimal. Remember, we hadn't seen a 5% or more correction in the same duration of that latest trend. So all of this is behavioral conditioning as part of, you know, FOMO and various other biases that overwhelm. So we should be getting a little bit cautious or fearful when others are getting greedy, but clearly cognitive biases and the behavioral elements kick in at these extremes. So 5,000 best case on the S&P 500. In terms of our global ranking model, we see cross-asset. So risk on markets like US, India, a little bit of the West and the East, representation there as being having their best performance at these highs. India in particular, just to switch regions, is what we're calling price to perfection. And although that might be a lesser traded market, it's really an interesting story for the whole risk on trade generally, but particularly in emerging markets. And so being at 20-year extremes, four standard deviations, it's just another indication of just how strong things have been. Asia is a long-term bull story for us ahead, but as part of this potential unraveling that'll take place in the next year or so, certainly it'll hit all markets, but more Western markets and highly valued markets more than others. And just in terms of strategic disconnects that we are seeing, another point I'd like to make is that we're getting kind of breakdowns in, for example, some of the corporate high yield spreads. If you invert that ratio and compare it to the equity markets, that's been kind of tracking back to back for some months now. But in the latest upswing higher that we've seen in the equity markets, we've seen an opposite divergence take place. So continue to watch that play out, and further divergences going on across credit. Breadth is also weakening with, I believe, all the S&P 500 industries trading at a 50 percentile of their long-term 200 moving average. And just finally, interesting to look at the small cap sector, Russell 2000, which has just broken below its one-year trend. And some of the open interest is suggesting that there's paradoxical greater fool theory in operation, where basically retail behaviors usually leverage at momentum extremes, sell quickly during a market correction, but instead they're getting bullish during the decline that we just saw, which suggests a catching the falling knife situation.
So Ron, any high conviction calls you have on the market currently? It sounds when you're looking at US markets, you think that there's a good chance we could be seeing some sort of significant peak in the first or second quarter. I think you said first quarter with drawdown possible in the second quarter. When you're looking at the US stock market, if I got that correct, long-term bullish on China. Any high conviction calls at this juncture that you'd like to share with our audience?
Yes. So right now, looking at our global ranking model, we're still as part of a tactical risk on theme, but that will likely rotate and unwind going into Q1 next year. So the big call is the big cycle is likely turning as we speak, but that will offer a tactical opportunity to the upside on some markets. As I mentioned earlier on, S&P, for example, back to 5,000. That would be a selective rotation in stocks, just to kind of add a little bit more on the bottom-up perspective. So expect cyclicals and value to outperform, whereas defensives and growth technology will likely underperform. One of our high conviction stock kind of risk mitigations that we're citing is for FANG stocks to be defanged at some point in time. And I, that's both from a technical and fundamental point of view. Technically, more as they breach their long-term moving averages. And if you look at the FANG index, that is something to watch out for. It did that in the summer, and then previous to that, of course, during the pandemic shock period. Currently trading at 7,000, but interesting, particularly as interest rates potentially surprise to the upside. That tends to be negative for tech. And although valuations are, rebounding from historically high levels, and we could just see more of the same. If you look at least Facebook and Amazon, they were the big decliners in the last shakeout. And so we could get a domino effect on the rest of the complex. And given that they are big market cap weighted of the S&P 500 and of this just general tech story leverage across the board, we're just kind of putting it in terms of that risk basket, watching it keenly, just to see how that may rotate and then ultimately unravel in the year of 2020. And just finally, in terms of where do people put their money, if and when that scenario plays out, big cycle turning, Minsky risk, which would be supplemented with elevated volatility in interest rates. Gold is still our favorite trade, although it has been so unloved this year and basically flatline. Continue to watch it holding above its long-term strategic 200 moving average. We do still see it outperforming in absolute and relative terms. So certainly back to the record highs, if not risk to 2,400 and maybe with a spike into 3,000, depending on the macro situation. And crypto, I think for those who are open to it and are okay to take a minimal kind of diversification play from their portfolio, we treat that as the bold trade. So a little bit of Bitcoin, a little bit of gold, or a blend of the two. And then obviously some cash reserves or some hedging to de-risk and diversify as markets potentially change season and the regime shifts.
Now, I know you look at long-term cycles. Some of our work has shown that you see a pattern that often carries through from cycle to cycle, and that's where the bond market will peak, followed by the stock market, and then commodities eventually peak later. And with inflation getting out of hand, one would think if that pattern were to hold true again, that we would finally see commodities peak, but with a lag. What are your thoughts? You said that you are bullish on precious metals, particularly gold, but what would be your thoughts on the wider commodity complex at this point?
Interesting question. And it seems to be a more of a bifurcated mix of performance. And so, I mean, gold being a case in point, flat this year and likely higher over the next year or so, particularly if we get a revived and persistent inflation story. Money has to find a home, particularly if it's seeking safety. What's interesting is if we look at kind of industrial metals and the so-called doctor copper, I mean, that continues to give us a pulse check reading. It's had a phenomenal run to the upside, but consolidated in recent months. It's held above its strategic averages, so that's still strong. But what we've been saying on that as a indication of growth trajectory, we think it's peak growth for now, and copper is potentially suggesting that. If you look at it on the index and LME levels, so that's around, 10,000 on LME, so big roundophobia level. I believe between 490 and 466, based on a long-term regression that we're working on. So copper looks like it's kind of aligning with a peak copper, peak growth story. But we are still long-term bullish on copper. But of course, you know, we're factoring in some of the shrinking in stocks and also just the technical short-term risks that can transpire. In terms of inflation, copper-gold ratio is one that we're watching. And of course, that's correlates well to rates, 10-year. And so right now that's range bound, I think for the year to date. So that would need to push higher to suggest that we're going to kind of hit a new market regime in terms of rate normalization. From a cycle perspective, we do look at economic cycles like the Kondratiev wave, which is a super wave cycle. And so we do see a bottom in rates already taking place, but that is a glacier structural move. And so it's likely within a multi-year period that we'll start to see this kind of step up transition in rates where we actually see that reflected more clearly. And of course, that'll be bullish for the commodity complex long-term. We just have to be careful not to expect a straight line going up in commodities. There will be different volatility profiles, and some of that complex will outperform others at different stages.
Yeah, and speaking of which, we have seen a pretty straight move in the aggregate for commodity complex as a whole so far. And obviously, there's some major deviations when you drill down. One commodity that we've been discussing periodically on our premium program during the week is uranium. There's been a lot of enthusiasm building in the uranium sector, especially as more nations are warming up to nuclear. It was last month that China had announced that they're going to build 150 new reactors, nuclear reactors, over the next 15 years. They're the largest emitter of carbon in the globe. And of course, they're really trying to get in front of that. And nuclear power is really the only way that a nation like theirs and other nations are going to be able to provide baseload electricity to their growing populations. And we see the same thing in India, in the Middle East, and also the European Union may be including nuclear to their green taxonomy. I believe the announcement for that would be coming December 22nd. So in a few weeks from now, we'll have to see how that plays out. But any thoughts on uranium or the nuclear sector at this point?
This is certainly a growth market based upon many of the key factors that you just highlighted. But for now, we do think it's tactically overdone and certainly looking for renewed buying opportunities ahead from an investment point of view.
So tactically overbought in the short term, but long-term opportunity. Well, Ron, as we close, I want to thank you for coming on to our show and give us an update on your outlook. With that said, would you mind telling our listeners how they can follow more of your work?
Yes, absolutely. So we welcome connecting on website, rwadvisory.com, and of course, following our work on social media, specifically LinkedIn and Twitter, where we're quite active. And we're happy to share kind of a complimentary trial access to our research for those who are interested. Just shoot me an email, rwilliam@rwadvisory.com, and just let us know that you are here listening to the Financial Sense podcast, and we're happy to follow up.
Ron, pleasure to get an update from you again. Have a great rest of the year and happy holidays to you.
Don't let higher inflation erode the value of your hard-earned wealth. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the price of energy has pulled back substantially, as we've seen it over the last couple of weeks over fears of the Omicron virus. But we're heading back up again. Do we get back to where we were before? Or is this the beginning of a long-term correction? Let's find out. Joining us on the program is Dan Steffens. Dan, let's go back about a month. We were up around $85 a barrel. You had Goldman Sachs and many others talking about $100 oil. And then all of a sudden on the Friday of Thanksgiving week, we fell tremendously. I think it was like a 10, 12% drop in a single day over fears of this new variant of the virus. Where do we go from here? And was that an overreaction by the market? At least it is in my opinion, but go ahead.
Yeah, in my opinion, it was too. And I think when they, you know, released that fear, Dr. Fauci picked the day, Black Friday, and, you know, and all these predictions of movement shutdowns and everything, we thought we were going back to the first quarter of 2020. But nothing changed from a supply and demand situation, and it is an oversold deal. What everybody needs to remember on, especially on holidays, short trading days, there's very few humans trading. So those sell-off was a bunch of computer algorithms triggered that hit the sell button all at the same time. And so you had that big cascade. But now, as over the weekend, we find out that the Omicron variant is less dangerous than they thought. Very few people are having to be hospitalized. And I think that's the key. So the fear level starts fading. And now we go back to looking at supply and demand fundamentals. And I can tell you, they're extremely tight. And above ground inventories all over the world are anywhere from 5 to 15% below the five-year average. They're too low. Are all of our inventories, crude oil and refined product inventories, need to be rebuilt because that supply chain is critical to the global economy. And so I think we're going to see a pretty sharp snapback, at least into the low 70s. And I think you got a good chance to see an 80 by Christmas.
Dan, let's go back a little over a year. I mean, we saw oil prices get to a negative 40 during the shutdown in February of 2020. But if you take a look at where the U.S. is today, I think at our peak, we were producing about 13 million barrels a day. In your opinion, what caused the spike in oil prices where we saw it go from, you know, the low 40s, 50s, 60s, all the way up to recently at 85? What's behind that, in your opinion?
Well, first of all, U.S. production did fall rapidly at first just because of well shut-ins, but then also because the upstream companies cut their drilling programs extensively. I mean, we dropped from, you know, 1,300 rigs drilling in the U.S. to, you know, 250. And we've only bounced back to like 500 or 600 today, total oil and gas, and less than 500 drilling for oil. And we probably need a good 650, 700 rigs drilling for oil to see any chance of rebuilding up our production, because these shale wells are on steady to steep decline. They come on strong, and they, at today's oil price, they pay out very quickly, some of them in less than 6 months. But the upstream companies need to keep drilling, completing wells in order to maintain production. So we're just now at a point where we're completing enough wells to pretty much hold production flat around 11.5 million barrels a day. But we're still, you know, then 1.5 million barrels below where we were. And if you look at all of the non-OPEC plus countries, we're probably down maybe 3 million barrels a day of production. So everybody looking at the demand side, but the supply side is going to take a long time to get back to pre-pandemic levels.
You know, one of the things that strikes me about this, and if we go back probably a decade or so, or probably more importantly, back to around 2014 when the decline in oil began from, you know, triple digits. Let's talk about investment in the industry, because we've seen company after company, maybe the one exception was Exxon. These companies began to pull back on their capital expenditures. They weren't investing in the upstream. And if you're in the oil business, you're producing oil. If you don't replace it, I mean, you're going to run out of inventory at some point. So that's one issue, which is lack of investment. The second one is what I call environmental activism. So you have Wall Street, I don't care if it's BlackRock, hedge fund managers are getting involved with the big oil companies, getting seats on the board. I can think of Exxon as a company that comes to mind. And these guys are asking these oil companies to divest themselves of assets. I can't think of anything dumber to do right now, because what that does, we reduce our production and try to go green. At the same time, we're still consuming fossil fuels, but it puts more power in the hands of OPEC.
Yeah, if anybody's watching the situation in Europe, they are extremely exposed to energy shortage right now, because they went green before they, you know, shut down oil, gas, and coal power generation. And here they stand where they're really looking at a shortage of heating fuels during this winter. And they've already had one cold spell. And you got their gas prices are five times, natural gas prices are five times higher than our gas price today, probably more like 10 times higher right now. And then you got this fear of, with Russia building up their military, look, you know, on the border of Ukraine, looking like they want to take Ukraine. Well, they rely heavily on gas coming from Russia. So, you know, the Europeans cannot get into any kind of a shooting war with Russia. And I think Putin knows that. So he's got a lot of leverage over the Europeans right now.
Yeah, Biden's supposedly talking with Putin, and he wants to get the Europeans to shut down the Russian pipelines. I don't think that's going to happen, as you mentioned, given what they're dealing with this approaching winter and lack of supply. Let's talk about some of the other things. You talk about green. One of the issues that we have in California, I think there's about 120 ships offshore the ports in Los Angeles. And part of the problem, Dan, is our environmental restrictions on diesel rigs coming into the state. So there's a shortage of drivers, a shortage of workers. And, you know, you talk to the merchants, whether you're at Best Buy or even talking to Apple. I mean, I ordered an Apple iPhone as soon as I could. I just got it this week. Talking to merchants, you can't get iPads, you can't get iWatches, all the popular items for Christmas. And at first I thought, why didn't you guys order more? And they said, we did. It's sitting in ships offshore. So as we move to this green transition, Dan, how in the hell are we going to get the fuel to power all this electricity we're going to need? Because as you and I know, wind and solar doesn't work.
Yeah, you know, everybody, 100% of people want a clean environment. We want clean air. We want clean water. We want everything. But, you know, we have to have a realistic energy policy that doesn't turn off oil, gas, and coal before they've built enough wind and solar or nuclear power plants to offset that. And you just can't, you know, the government's opposing every single pipeline. I saw that some state would not approve a compressor station for a pipeline coming into their state. And so that's going to make their natural gas prices for space heating go higher in that state. I mean, it's just crazy. And we just have to have a realistic step back. And it would help if the federal government would actually include industry people in these discussions instead of a bunch of environmental zealots that they don't care. They don't care if the middle class people are forced to pay three times more for their gasoline and, you know, their space heating fuels. I guess they just don't care because they don't act like it. That's for sure.
California seems to be going the way of Europe. I mean, we're closing down our final nuclear power plant in 2025, which means California will lose another 10% of its electricity. At the same time, we're putting in these mandates, whether it's on diesel trucks coming into the state, buying cars. The idea is by 2030, we're going to be all green and we're going to be driving electric cars. I don't see that happening. First of all, they're more expensive. Second, you're going to need, I think the figure is 1.2 million charging stations in this state. And if we're going to be burning or using electricity, charging our cars at night, we're going to need more electricity. So here we are doing these mandates, kind of like what Europe did. At the same time, we're shutting down our sources of providing that electricity. I don't think these guys really think this through.
It sure doesn't seem like they do to me. In my opinion, and I'll tell your listeners, I have nothing against wind and solar. I mean, I've recommended companies that make the materials like copper and lithium and graphite that are very important to the transition to a more electrification. The problem I have is just they're not doing it in a realistic manner. And in my opinion, what we should be focused on is how can we reduce emissions from coal-fired power plants or oil-fired power plants or even natural gas? What can we do there? And I think that would be probably easier and cheaper. I think we could and maybe even carbon, you know, pumping the CO2 down into the ground. That can be done. And I think we could, you know, get to net zero a lot faster that way than just forcing everybody to go, you know, wind and solar and put solar panels on the roof and all that kind of stuff and subsidizing all that. But, you know, they're just so anti-oil and gas, you can't really have realistic discussions with these guys.
Well, and the other surprising thing, if you're an environmentalist, one of the cleanest sources of electricity out there and the most effective for its blueprint or footprint is nuclear power. I mean, some of the technology that has come about in the nuclear industry over the last several decades, you compare the footprint of a nuclear power plant and the amount of electricity it can produce, and you compare that to, like, Las Vegas, where Warren Buffett's utility company is building a solar farm. I think it's like 7,000 acres or something like that, or 7,000 panels or something outside of Las Vegas. You compare that to the footprint of a nuclear power plant.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, there's easier ways to do it. And wind and solar make a lot of sense in some areas, and they make, you know, no sense. I mean, you can't put solar panels up in northern Wisconsin or anything. That's not going to work. But, you know, in the desert outside of Las Vegas, I'm sure that makes a lot of sense. But they're just so inefficient when compared to nuclear or coal or natural gas, or, you know, 5 or 10 times more efficient in producing electricity.
You know, the funny thing about it is you see these politicians, whether it's in Germany. I mean, France has been powering electricity with nuclear power plants. I think it provides about 75% of their electricity. They've been doing this for decades. There's never been an accident. I just don't understand what the issue is against nuclear power plants. If you want to get to zero emissions, you want electricity, you want electric cars, you need to have a dependable source of electricity to make this all work.
Yeah, I think it's just that, you know, our politicians, I'm sure every state senator basically says, look, nobody in my district wants a nuclear power plant, not in their neighborhood. You know, you can build it out in the middle of Nevada or something, but I don't want it next to my, you know, city in, you know, North Carolina or something. So they probably just decided that nuclear just won't sell with their voters. So they've decided to not even mention it. It's never even mentioned in any of the energy plans that I see.
So one of the things that strikes me, as you mentioned, our production's down about, 1.5 million barrels a day. And you take a look at these estimates as the economies come back, and it turns out, with the exception maybe of Europe, that lockdowns here didn't work, number one. Number two, I doubt if the public is going to be open to more lockdowns without some kind of rebellion against this, as we're seeing with the vaccines. But talking about future investment, you're talking about consumption today is going to be, we're approaching 100 million barrels a day. Dan, where are we going to get this extra energy? Because we're still consuming more and economies are still growing. You need more fuel.
Yeah, even today, oil demand for oil-based products exceeds supply today. All U.S. inventories of distillates, that's home heating oil, diesel, gasoline, and propane is just terribly too low. Natural gas is even below the five-year average. All these inventories are significantly below the five-year average, and we consume more than we did 5 years ago. So what's supporting the oil price now, and why it's going to bounce back quickly once the fear of this variant subsides. And everything I'm reading is it may be contagious, but it's not deadly. So it's not going to overwhelm the hospitals. It's not, you know, a whole bunch of people aren't dying. And the news out of South Africa is that, more people are getting it, but they're getting over it. And they've only had to hospitalize a few people. So if that's truly the case and that fear fades, you're going to get back to the knowledge that we must start rebuilding these inventories, because you talk about your, you know, container ships offshore. Well, if we start having, you know, regional shortages of, and I think you're going to see it for sure in propane. Propane in the Midwest is already being rationed. It's being rationed in Texas. You're going to see rationing of fuel. And once you start seeing ration of gasoline, then all the voters, consumers/voters, are going to be screaming at Washington to back off and, you know, get these things that we live on today back in place, because we're not going to put up with it. This is going to doom the Democratic Party if they keep it down this path.
So, you know, if we look at the price of oil, it's bouncing back. On the day you and I are speaking, it's around $68 a barrel. It's down from around 85. It looks like it could be heading up. The one surprising thing this time around, Dan, is the oil stocks have held up pretty well. I mean, some of these companies, as you were well aware, are paying very rich dividends. I mean, Warren Buffett has taken a sizable position in Chevron, which has a dividend yield of almost 5%. So let's talk about the energy stocks, because they seem to be holding up much better than the price of fuel.
Well, if you recall, I mean, when we talked 6 or 8 months ago, my prediction was that $65 was the right price for oil. And I can tell you that all the upstream companies that I follow would be extremely profitable and generate a lot of free cash flow if oil settled at $65, but I don't think it's going to stay there. And I really think the stars are aligned, let's say, for a spike to $100 oil within 6 months. Because within 6 or 8 months, OPEC Plus is going to run out of spare capacity. And there's nothing, nobody else is going to be able to step up to the plate. The U.S. will not be able to step up and ramp up production by 2 million barrels a day or something. So there is a lot of upside. But I'll assure your listeners that if oil settles in the $65 to $70 range, these companies are going to be fine, and they're going to have some spectacular fourth quarter. Just right now, they had very good third quarter results. And unless WTI would go down to 60 and stay there for the rest of December, the oil price is going to average more in the fourth quarter than it did in the third quarter. And these companies are going to report outstanding fourth quarter results, lots of free cash flow. A lot of them are raising their dividends. Their year-end reserve reports are going to be fantastic based on higher oil and gas prices. Based on SEC guidelines, they're going to be able to, instead of valuing their oil at $47 a barrel, which they had to do last year in their reserve reports, they're going to be valuing their reserves at $65 oil and $3.50 or $4 gas. And those reserve reports are going to show that their assets are worth a lot more than their book value. And a lot of these companies are trading at near book value, and their breakup values may be 50% or 100% more than what their assets are really worth. We're looking at an interesting next few months for this sector. And if people are looking for dividends, some of these companies like Devon, Pioneer, they're paying outstanding dividends. And several of them that are announced variable dividend programs where they have a base dividend and then they have a variable dividend based on their free cash flow. And according to my forecast valuation models, there are some very good companies that are going to have double-digit dividends next year based on where they're trading today. So, Wall Street, so they'll move where they can get high yield. And this sector is going to be offering a lot, especially the midstream companies too.
Well, this seems like we're lining up for what I call the perfect storm. If you take a look at oil prices heading to oil, as you mentioned, if you talk about the Federal Reserve cutting back on the bond buying and possibly raising interest rates, and the administration raising taxes. So raising taxes, higher oil prices, higher interest rates, to me, does not spell well for the economy by mid-year next year. So we'll have to wait to see. Dan, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work you do at Energy Prospectus, tell them how they could do so.
Yeah, they can just send an email to energyprospectus@gmail.com. That's one word, energyprospectus@gmail.com. And that'll go to Sabrina. She handles member services, and she will give them a promo code so they can get $100 off the first year of a subscription to our service. We basically do the due diligence that investors should be doing before they invest. And I provide what I believe are accurate forecast models. And we also do publish about 50 company profiles per year. We're looking at upstream oil and gas primarily, but also midstream, some small cap oil field service companies that look really good right now. And we have a high yield income portfolio for those that are looking for dividend yield. So or they could just, call me at 281-435-8874, and I'll give it to them.
All right. Well, listen, Dan, you have a Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and come back to us next year.
Chris, last week you discussed how we've now seen a large cluster of Hindenburg omens popping up on every single major U.S. index. We haven't seen this happen since January or February of 2020, right before the COVID crash. We posted a chart of this on our website, and it got a lot of attention. We're going to post an updated version of some of the charts that we're going to discuss today that all of you can look at. But tell us, what's the message from this and other indicators you are looking at in terms of what we saw take place with the market this week?
We saw a bunch of signals prior to Thanksgiving. So, kind of wasn't surprising to see the market sell off. I look at these across, small cap, mid cap, large cap, the NASDAQ, to get a look at different areas of the market. And, the earliest signal I started to see, the first one I saw was on the Russell 2000 small cap. And that happened November 17th. And I got a follow-up signals on the 18th, the 19th, as well as the 23rd. And then I also started to see a cluster of signals in the S&P 400 mid cap from the 18th all the way through pre-Thanksgiving, the 24th. And then we saw, I would say the first signal I saw for the S&P came on December 1st. So the other areas were showing more weakness than large cap. The strongest area of the market so far this year really has been large cap tech. But even looking at the Nasdaq, which is tech dominated, there's still a lot of small cap tech issues and other names in the Nasdaq. And the Nasdaq had several signals. It had three in late November, and it had an additional one December 1st. So, you know, I think that trend is continuing of what we saw last month. For example, today, when I look at the various indices, I've seen twice as many stocks hitting new lows, one-month lows on the Russell 2000 than high. So it does continue to point that the strongest area of the market is large cap, particularly large cap tech. Outside of that, there's a tremendous amount of weakness. And that does have me concerned as we head into 2022.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Financial Sense Wealth Management Global Stimulus Index you've created and what this is pointing towards in terms of economic growth for next year?
What we did is we looked at monetary policy globally, and monetary policy, as well as fiscal, hits the economy with a lag. And so what we did is we looked at global central bank policy rates and their level of change. And we weighted it basically based on the size of the of each country's economy. And it does a pretty good job of predicting turns in global manufacturing activity. And what it suggests is that the change on the margin over the last year has been towards tightening versus easing. And that suggests that we're going to see a peak in global economic activity right about now. And we should see a steady decline throughout the bulk of 2022. And I think that's what we're starting to see, is this potential peak in economic momentum, as well as peak in global liquidity, I think is making it more difficult for risk assets to continue to rally higher in the face of headwinds versus tailwinds, as what we saw in the last 2 years.
So in terms of market outlook, and you do have a chart showing global money supply overlaid with the S&P 500, it would appear, given the decline that we are now seeing in global money supply, that we should at least be preparing for volatility. Is that the main takeaway?
It is. I definitely think the upside is going to be more limited than what we've seen previously. For example, one of the things I touched upon in our Monday meeting was that global liquidity started to really roll over in August. And when we look at certain areas of the market since global liquidity peaked, we can see some significant deterioration in former high-flying areas. You know, I know a lot of people are familiar with Cathie Wood and her ARK ETFs that focus in disruptive technology. Well, the ARK Innovation ETF since August, and this goes through last Friday, is down nearly 30% just since August. And you look at other areas like biotech is down nearly 20%. The Goldman Sachs Most Shorted Index is down 13% off of its highs. So there's some definite unraveling beneath the surface going on in the market. And I think that really does reflect liquidity. You know, as the saying goes, a rising tide lifts all boats. Well, you can have the opposite. You know, a falling tide sinks all boats. I think we're seeing more and more boats begin to fall. And one of the things we've highlighted recently, when you look at the Russell 3000, and that's 98% of the entire U.S. stock market capitalization, you're seeing, and this was as of last Friday, half of the market is in a bear market. And I'm talking 20% or more off their highs. So when you've got, you know, Apple and the S&P and the NASDAQ hitting new all-time highs, well, half the market is down by 20%. That's a very unhealthy, selective market. And to me, I think that's really representative of that peak in global liquidity.
So global liquidity is falling. We're likely to see a peak in global growth. What are we seeing in terms of credit markets currently, and why is it important to look at this area?
The reason why it's important to look at the credit markets is the credit markets, basically like the financial markets, do better when growth is rising and liquidity is abundant. And that's typically when you see credit spreads come down. And credit spreads are basically just the difference in yield between a risk-free asset like a U.S. Treasury and a risk asset like investment grade or junk bonds. And what we saw with credit spreads were incredibly low. I mean, we're talking you know, basically matching 10, 20-year lows until recently. And what we started to notice last month was that credit spreads were starting to move up for the first time since the March 2020 bottom. So again, you know, you're starting to kind of check off the boxes for a kind of corrective period. Credit spreads widening, economic growth peaking, liquidity falling. These are all starting to sing the same tune. So for me, I would say the closest analogy would probably be 2018. 2018, we had global growth was falling, except for the U.S. because of the tax stimulus. It was still fairly robust. But risk assets were declining. You had junk bonds were selling off, credit spreads were rising, commodities were selling, you know, pretty much everything was going down except for U.S. tech. But eventually, there was so much of the market falling that they eventually brought down the index where the S&P peaked in October of 2018 in the face of interest rate hikes by the Federal Reserve under Jerome Powell, as well as the Fed was doing quantitative tightening, shrinking its balance sheet. So fast forward to today, while the Fed isn't hiking interest rates yet, we still have a pretty substantial loss in liquidity. As you and I, Chris, have remarked, you know, more than $1 trillion has come out of this market and gone into the repo facility. And to me, that's almost like quantitative tightening, where you're pulling money out of the financial system. That's effectively what the Fed did in 2018 and in 2019. And I think that's what's, you know, effectively being done by the repo facility. And now the Fed is starting to actually do tapering and slowing its purchases. And what financial markets cares, yes, the Fed is still putting money into the market, but it's the rate of change. I mean, that's really what the markets care about, is the change on the margin. And when you look at the growth of the Fed's balance sheet, it will be going down substantially, all the way to the point of zero year-over-year growth. So I think that's really starting to be reflected in financial markets, and it does set up the potential for us entering into a corrective period, just like what we saw in late 2018.
Well, and we have seen a major pivot by the Fed, Jay Powell, now saying we need to retire the word transitory from inflation, a warning about the risk of persistent inflation. Of course, we've been talking about this for a very long time, lining on the persistent side. Jay Powell is now caught up to that view, but with that is now the risk of pulling back liquidity much faster than originally anticipated. And I believe at this point, perhaps you can clarify, but I believe market is now pricing in 2 to 3 rate hikes for 2022. Is that correct?
That's correct. And, you know, that's kind of the big question mark going into next year, is that's not what the Fed's pricing in. So who has it wrong? Is the market wrong or is the Fed wrong? And if the market really is pricing in 3 rate hikes, you know, it's really surprising to see the indices as strong as they are in the face of, you know, potential rate hikes ahead. So I think that's the big question, is the Fed going to play catch up and change its outlook, and that rhetoric then begin to impact the market? Because the market, you know, as you mentioned, is pricing in 2 to 3 rate hikes. But when we looked at what happened last week, when Powell was talking about retiring the word transitory and possibly accelerating the tapering process, the markets didn't take that too well. The markets, you know, were selling off last week. So I think if the Fed is going to play catch up with the markets, it's a weird scenario where the markets are already pricing it in and have discounted it, so to speak, because that's what the futures market is saying. But I don't know if it's necessarily being reflected by equity investors. Because again, with the Fed last week talking about a faster taper, you know, why would the market sell off if it was already kind of pricing in 2 to 3 rate hikes? So, you know, I have the thought that there's parts of this market that are not pricing in a more aggressive Fed, particularly the equity markets and the credit markets. So, you know, if the Fed does play catch up to what the futures market is saying in terms of 2 to 3 rate hikes, possibly a faster taper, that could certainly, I think, lead to some market weakness ahead.
Well, Chris, I want to note that when we spoke with you early November, stocks had hit a record high at the time. You said things were likely to start getting bumpy, especially when we think about declining liquidity, not just here in the U.S., but globally, deterioration, credit markets, a number of these things that you watch. So at this point, is the message still for investors, stay cautious, stay nimble, and be prepared for more volatility as we head into 2022?
I think so. I mean, we're, like I said, until these trends change, I think that's the name of the game. I mean, again, falling economic growth, falling global liquidity, and declining market breadth data. I think all of these things are going to be headwinds for the market, which would warrant more of a defensive posture from what we've seen over the last, you know, year and a half until those key inputs change.
Well, Chris, it was a pleasure speaking with you on another edition of Smart Macro. Normally, we speak with you every 2 weeks, but obviously, given what we've seen with the market volatility over this last week and a number of charts that you've been posting and discussing in your videos, very important things to be looking at. So we definitely want to encourage all of you listening to check out these charts and also the most recent weekly market videos so that you'll understand why we at Financial Sense Wealth Management are definitely taking a more cautious tone as we look towards 2022. Chris, it was a pleasure speaking with you on our show once again, and we look forward to speaking with you most likely in another couple weeks.
Thanks, Chris. It was a pleasure being on, and have a great weekend.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888, that's 888-486-3939, or go to financialsense.com and click where it says Contact Us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense News Hour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.